beat goes on. The beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee. La da 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 da. Charleston was once the rage, uh-huh. History has turned a page, uh-huh. The mini skirt's the current thing, uh-huh. Goes on, the beat goes on. The drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee, la da 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 da. The grocery store, the supermarket. Men still keep on marching off to war. Electrically they keep a baseball score. And the beat goes on. The beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee. La da 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 da.
Grandma's sitting in chairs and reminisce.
Boys keep chasing girls to get a kiss.
The cars keep a going faster all the time. Goes on. The beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee. La da 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 da.
And the beat goes on.
Yes, the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on.
Eric, it's great to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you, and you're a trooper here because we're trying something. Well, in your book, and this is the first of an incessant number of plugs for your book, which I think is fantastic. Drums and Demons, on the great drummer Jim Gordon. You've been interviewed before, but what we're trying to do here is really do a musical encyclopedia of this guy's amazing work. So we're not just going to talk about the...
Well, in 3 hours, we should be able to scratch the surface.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I've done to give you an idea, folks, here's a simple question. Let's orient people. That's probably a pretty good idea. Drums and Demons is about Jim Gordon. Drums and Demons. Explain the title to me, Joel, and I think that'll explain what we're dealing with here with this guy's life story.
Well, from 1964 to 1975, Jim was probably the leading drummer in the rock field. As a Hollywood session musician, as a member of Derek and the Dominoes, of Delaney and Bonnie, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, Traffic. I played on a bunch of number one records. Jim's story is very tragic. He was schizophrenic. And as he struggled to maintain his life against this terrible mental illness, it got the better of him. And over the course of 5 years, he degenerated to where he could really barely take care of himself. And he ended up murdering rather brutally his mother. That's what he's remembered for now. And as Jim Gordon went to jail, spent half his life in prison. He died last year at the age of 78. But that's what he's remembered for. And my book, I set out to restore Jim Gordon to a full life. Schizophrenia is incredibly common, Eric. It exists in 1 in 100 in the general population. And of those people who are diagnosed, only half respond to treatment. So this is just this horrible scourge. And Jim battled this pretty much his whole life and rather successfully for a long time. In fact, he was never diagnosed by any of the many, many psychiatrists he saw. And I mean many. There were 15 hospital admissions in 5 years. That means like every couple of months he'd check into a mental hospital.
He was trying to get better. He was trying to quell the demons in his head. He was trying to fight back.
Fighting this, everything he got. And none of the psychiatrists could diagnose him. They saw him maybe depressive, maybe mood disorder, but they didn't suspect schizophrenia because he was so high functioning. Now, I want to say two things and then we'll go on, but just there's two things that are very important. One is that when Jim played the drums, his disease vanished. I'm sure of that. That the combination of the report of the drums and the hypnotic effect of the rhythmic entrainment, the mighty groove, it just encompasses your consciousness to a degree that there is no room for mental illness. So when Jim played drums, he was confident, he was in charge, he was in command, he was safe. When he wasn't, he didn't. It was a different story.
Well, part of what I want to do here, too, is we call us radio professionals call this front announcing, where you don't play a song and then say, well, you just heard, and let's talk about the song you just heard. I want to do what we call front announcing, which is dial listeners in on what Jim is doing. You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
Because we're going to be playing, I'll give you a hint, folks. We're going to be playing some of the most familiar songs of your life. You've heard these songs a million times, I swear to God. But you haven't heard them with the Jim Gordon filter on. And we're going to turn that Jim Gordon filter on and point out what to listen for. And I thought we'd start, Joel, with the Beach Boys, I'm Waiting for the Day. Yeah, that's an interesting percussive track, and this is a little out of chronological order, but it's a track you've heard before, but you probably didn't know that's Jim Gordon. Is there anything you can tell us about his work on?
Yeah, this is Jim started playing with the Beach Boys during the Pet Sounds sessions, and this is Jim at the trap set, and the timpani is played by a session musician named Gary Coleman. And the two of them combine for a completely thunderous rhythm track in here. And this is sort of the beginning of Jim's association with Brian Wilson.
Love began to guess I'm saying you're the only one. I'm waiting for the day when you can love me. I'm saying you're the only one. I'm waiting for the day when you can love again.
Jim Gordon and the Beach Boys. I'm here with Joel Selvin, author of Drums and Demons. I almost said Demons and Drums, but you probably agree, Joel, they go hand in hand and back and forth with this tortured artist. One, it's easy to, we know, but I want to make a mention to our listeners that the Beach Boys didn't play on their records, certainly by Pet Sounds. They weren't playing a whole lot on their records. So that would have been the Wrecking Crew, which I notice in your book, you're very careful not to go there. You describe the ensemble of musicians that Jim Gordon played with in the mid-60s on just about every hit record released, but you don't call them the Wrecking Crew. I'm curious why you steered clear of that.
Well, it's what I want to say, a non-contemporaneous nomenclature.
Ooh, I like that. Non-contemporaneous. Hey. You ought to consider a career as a writer, Joel. I'm just throwing this out here.
It was a gag title that Hal Blaine dreamed up for the loose group of session musicians who operated in Los Angeles, and it's not sure when, and it's not sure who belongs. Could be 30 people, could be 50 people. But that's a Hal Blaine joke, and Hal Blaine was a well-known gagster. My pal, Steve Douglas, was a sax player that was on all those records. If it wasn't Plas Johnson, it was Steve. It's him on Peter Gunn by Duane Eddy and the Do Ron Ron by the Crystals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Steve just was annoyed as heck about the Wrecking Crew thing. And I understand, because it kind of trivializes the contributions, and it's also so inexact. I mean, Dean Parks really didn't start doing sessions until 72, 73. Is he in the Wrecking Crew or not? I don't know. Sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't.
Well, you mentioned Hal Blaine, and again, we're getting into the weeds here, but Hal Blaine, anyone who knows anything about drumming knows that Hal Blaine is, whatever records Jim Gordon didn't drive, it was Hal Blaine who played on the rest. And you make a point that when Jim was coming up, and we're going to kind of weave chronologically through here, Hal Blaine didn't see Jim as a rival and try to shut him out of the studio. He really saw Jim as a protege and put him in sessions. But I think you mentioned it was because there was so much work to go around that Hal couldn't make some sessions, so he happily had his boy go. But can you describe that sort of period where Jim was integrating into that crack group of LA musicians?
So Jim left, graduated from high school in 1963, and the next day he went on the road with the Everly Brothers, kind of starting out at the top. And he came to the attention of other musicians in the Los Angeles recording scene. And there was this flash. When you saw Jim Gordon play, you'd never seen anybody play drums like that before, no matter who you were. So he was immediately adopted into the Los Angeles recording session. In 1964, things were just starting to expand in Los Angeles. By 1965, it was one of the recording capitals of the world, and they were kicking out hit records, not just by the Beach Boys, Sonny and Cher, Nancy Sinatra, Herb Alpert.
The Lenny Stones Hammer. Came to town and recorded, I think, wasn't Satisfaction recorded in Los Angeles at Gold Star?
RCA Studios with Dave Hassinger, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So, no, and Phil Spector moved out from New York, and Dick Clark moved out from Philadelphia. And Los Angeles was just exploding as a recording center in those years. And right at the heart of it were these session musicians who played three sessions a day, 6 days a week, honing their skills to an incredible level. I mean, they were good when they went in there, and when they were done after a couple of years of playing that kind of on that kind of level, there was nobody in the world who could match them.
Well, let's start. You mentioned the Everly Brothers. I was going to play Love is Strange. And tell me again, what should we be dialing in with Jim Gordon and the Everly Brothers? And this would be, what, 20-year-old Jim Gordon? This is a kid right out of high school.
Every record Jim's on, he brings something special to it. Whether it's an off-kilter fill, whether it's reallocating the second and third beats, whether it's dividing the time in some sort of unusual way, there's going to be a touch. It's an intuitive thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention earlier is that I am convinced that Jim's skills, which are almost supernatural, come from the same biochemical system that his disease is rooted in.
Interesting.
So you can hear it. You know, the way he staggers into a chorus, the way he underlines a verse, a little pop that you hadn't expected. There's something special in every Jim Gordon drum track.
This is Love is Strange, 20-year-old Jim Gordon. Graduates high school. Next day he goes on the road with the Everly Brothers.
Call your baby home. Well, if I needed her real bad, I guess I would call her like this. Home, please hold me.
Love is Strange, the Everly Brothers, and yeah, he sounds like Jim Gordon sounds like a playful metronome there. You can, and again, when you tune him in, Joel, you really can hear what he's doing. This is a Not What a Week. If you're tuning in for What a Week expecting acerbic comments on politics, you're not going to get it here. In fact, this is a 2 hour and 40 minutes now, a celebration of the music of Jim Gordon, cross-cut with the tragedy of his life and sad passing last year. But we're going to try to stick to the music. Joining me is Joel Selvin, author of Drums and Demons, a title that encapsulates the whole story. Anything to add to Jim and the Everly Brothers? Hearing that again,
yeah.
Joel, to tell me.
Yeah, you know who plays guitar on that track?
If it isn't Glenn Campbell, I will eat a hat.
Glenn Campbell and James Burton.
Oh, my God. That is the Mount Olympus of guitars. So Glenn Campbell, folks, and we'll be getting to Glenn Campbell, I promise you, in not too long. And James Burton, pretty much, well, I won't say the greatest guitarist of all time, but I've spent, and Joel, you and I have spent some time together with Richard Thompson. I know that Richard Thompson, who's a devout Muslim, the only time that he ever allowed alcohol in his fridge was the time when James Burton came by to visit. He felt that was time to put the beer in the fridge. So
I got a phone call at 11 o'clock at night from a very excited Henry Kaiser.
Oh, he's always very excited.
Who was in the studio with Richard Thompson, and Richard Thompson had just found out that James Burton had appeared on American television every week in the 50s. Backing up Ricky Nelson. And Henry wanted to bring Richard over to look at the videotapes. And I said, Henry, it's 11 o'clock at night. You know, come over in the morning. How soon?
Except
9, I guess, you know. And 9 a.m., those guys were there with a bag of croissants ready to look at old videotapes. Yeah, Thompson really, really loved James Burton.
And I must point out Henry Kaiser, who we just name-checked. I don't know if you know this, Jill, but next week I'm doing a three-hour Grateful Dead show with Henry. He's going to sit in playing. Henry Kaiser is going to curate what he thinks are Garcia's greatest guitar solos. And I've told Henry, you know this, I do a Dead show every week, I'm kind of up to speed on this, you pick the playlist and you tell me why you're making these choices. So just a little promo
that's one for the ages, Eric.
Yeah, it should be interesting. We rock and we roll on KSQD. But Everly Brothers, so a 20-year, at this point the Everly Brothers are in one of their many, many comebacks, right? They've had more comebacks than, I don't know.
Just... Oh, I wouldn't say they were coming back to anything.
Were they still at still like charting?
Yeah, nothing's going on for the Everly Brothers, but they were a live attraction. They toured England once or twice a year. They were always good for a summer tour of the United States, but their records were not an issue at that point, no matter how well they were made. You know, Don and Phil were just yesterday's papers, although everybody in the music business knew who they were. And they were really, along with Ricky Nelson, the last guys from the 50s rock and roll scene that were still operating.
Now, when they're touring, and Jim Gordon's touring at 20 years old, don't some I've heard some English obscure musicians were attending the gigs, and Jim met a couple of these guys who later on in his career he would run into again in different circumstances. Can you fill our listeners in on that little story?
Yeah, in September of 1963, when he was supposed to be starting college, he went to England to tour with the Everly Brothers. They were on the top of a bill that also included Little Richard and Bo Diddley. And the opening act was a band out of London that had just had their first record out. They'd never played outside of London. That was the Rolling Stones. That was the beginning of their career.
Huh. And then Paul, I think, I'm pretty sure Paul from the popular 60s recording act, the Beatles, he was always checking out the competition since John and Paul, besides Buddy Holly, definitely practiced those harmonies with the Everly Brothers. Didn't he hook up with Jim at that time, too?
Yeah, there was a close encounter at a nightclub, and you know, Paul introduced himself, and But, you know, of all the Beatles, that was the only one Jim never played with.
And later on, yes, we'll keep a little surprises here, but let's just a very famous John Lennon record and a lot of George Harrison album that you'll recognize. And by the time we're getting to that, you'll be able to spot Jim's drum work here. Joel's choice. Do you want to play? What would you like to play from the list of stuff that we got? And again, I'd like to dial people in on Jim Gordon so we know what to look for.
Well, you know, Wichita Lineman's a big deal for Glenn Campbell. And it's Jim on brushes until the last chorus. And then he makes a very stealthy switch to sticks and drives the record all the way home. It's a beautiful piece.
And listening to this too, you know, this isn't something where they're doing multiple takes, and it's not Brian Wilson doing Good Vibrations across 4 or 5 months. This was pretty much into the studio. Isn't it true, A Gentle On My Mind, it was Glenn Campbell's demo, and they had a half hour left on another session, and they recorded five tracks in a half hour, one of them being Gentle On My Mind? Am I correct in that?
The union contract shows a 3-hour session and 5 songs. So I don't know about where the half hour comes from.
Oh, okay.
But 5 songs in 3 hours is doing pretty good.
And if one of them, go ahead.
Gentle On My Mind, the Glenn gave some instructions over the introduction to the musicians. And when the demos came out, the guy at the record company just edited the instructions out and put the record out.
Let's do a 2-pack. How about this? Let's do Gentle On My Mind, which was a demo. Really, this is Glenn Campbell. They just knocked it off. And then we'll do Wichita Lineman, two Glenn Campbell songs. You've heard a million times, but you haven't heard dialed in just this way.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line. That keeps you in the back roads by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on their columns now that bind me, or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be cursing or forgiving when I walk along some railroad track and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you're just gentle on my mind. Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us, and some other woman's crying to her mother 'cause she turned and I was gone, I still might run in silence, tears of joy might stain my face, and a summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you walking on the back roads by the rivers flowing gentle on my mind. I dip my cup of soup back from a gurgling, crackling cauldron in some train yard. My beard a roughening coal pile and a dirty hat pulled low across my face. Through cupped hands round the tin can, I pretend to hold you to my breast and find that you're waiting from the back roads by the rivers of my memories, ever smiling, ever gentle on my mind.
It's
So when it comes to Topper, Top the Topper, so that's Gentle on My Mind. That was Glenn's first hit record, correct, Joel?
Yep, after many, many, many tries.
And then Wichita Lineman, this is the great Jimmy Webb song, By the Time I Get to Phoenix. Funny, I just heard the 20-minute Isaac Hayes version of that, so I've got that thing rattling around in my brain. But
good.
Listening in now, so what on Wichita Lineman, what should we be listening for here?
Cute little six-note intro from bassist Carol Kay. Wonderful guitar solo that Glenn Campbell tunes his guitar way down and does a kind of Duane Eddy thing. And then a big string section coming in over a very fancy organ part that was played on a fancy piece. And then Jim switching to sticks and driving it home.
And I'm keeping you on hot, as they say, in a professional radio land. So while we're listening, if you something you want to say, point something in the right direction over the track. I think we can be forgiven for most of these songs because everyone has heard these songs a gazillion times. So if they're slightly annotated,
it's good to listen to.
Oh, no. I understand. But what I'm saying is don't hesitate to geek out on something. If we were sitting in the living room and you were playing, and you know, us music nerds have done this a lot to people. Listen here. Listen to that. Just feel free to chime. I'm not saying you have to do it, but don't hesitate to go. But Wichita Lineman, Glenn Campbell.
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another. I hear you singing in the wire, I can hear you through the whine, and the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. That what a great line. It always kills me every time I hear it. I assume that's Glenn on the electric guitar. I mean,
Yep.
Is that Glenn just overdubbing himself all over the place, or was there something?
I don't think there's overdubs there. I think the strings are overdubbed, but I think that's a track. And all the drummers just go, how did he do that? Because he hits the four with a brush and has the one with a drumstick, and it's like he had it in his hand the whole time.
Well, the thing about, again, he fits right in with the song. The song, you know, he's just doing what he needs, exactly what he needs to do, amazingly, intricately, and you don't notice that he's doing it unless, of course, you're listening as hard and closely as we are during this now 2.5-hour exploration, spelunking into the great music and tragic life of the great drummer Jim Gordon on KSQD. I'm Eric Nelson, and I'm with Joel Selvin. And if you ever picked up a copy of the Chronicle to read anything about music from, what, 1972 to when did you sort of get your...
2009.
Wow, that's a lot of evenings at Winterland and one of the great music venues of all time, the Cow Palace. You can
yep. The I parking both places.
Oh yeah. Well, no, I envied you from afar. You definitely had a dream gig there
I thought.
But now you've graduated to writing books, and Drums and Demons is just one of them. I've read your Altamont book. I was, as a card-carrying deadhead, the book on the – it's a farewell. What's the book?
Fare Thee Well
on the afterlife, the somewhat tortured afterlife of the Grateful Dead. That's a show in itself, I have to say. But we're focusing here on Jim Gordon, and I was surprised reading your book. I'm rarely surprised about music history, but this kind of knocked me out was Jim Gordon hooking up with Merle Haggard. You know, I knew obviously James Burton, you know, I won't say the world's greatest guitarist, but I don't think there's a guitarist on earth who would argue very hard with you or say, well, that's not a valid thing to throw out there, right? We know that James Burton played with Merle Haggard, but what was the environment? Because I thought Merle was a Capitol guy. I didn't, but again, so were the Beach Boys. But how did Merle and...
So was Glenn Campbell. Oh. The producer was named Ken Nelson. He was a very cunning guy that had been running the Capitol Country program since like 1951. And he had Merle on the charts, kind of happening. And he thought, bringing in some extra firepower for the next session. So he brought in Merle's band. And then he also brought in James Burton and Glenn Campbell. And it was Burton who brought Jim Gordon along.
Interesting.
And that was all she wrote. Merle Haggard used Jim on session after session. He was Merle Haggard's favorite drummer.
Well,
that's him on Mama Try. That's him on Lonesome Fugitive, all the Jimmy Rogers album.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, a musical chameleon, and hang out with Clapton one day, Sonny and Cher the next, and then... And then Merle Haggard. So I thought I'd play A Bottle Let Me Down. And is there anything, again, dialing our ears in, anything about this record that we should listen closely?
Well, I wanted to reflect on your last comment. It was Jim's great gift to see the drums as a wholly musical instrument and not as a timekeeping device or a backbeat machine, but as something that would be embedded in the entire fabric of the composition. And that's what you were talking about. And that was Jim's great gift, because drums are a necessity, the art of accompaniment. And those of us, you know, don't even pay much attention to the drums. They just sort of are in the firmament of every record. But Jim had this ability to see the whole composition and to push his drums into the music of it.
Bottle Let Me Down, Merle Haggard. Is James Burton on this one?
Yep.
Yeah, so it doesn't get much better than this.
Burton and Campbell.
Each night I leave the bar room when it's over, not feeling any pain at closing time. But tonight your memory found me much too sober. Couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Tonight bottle let me down. And let your memory come around. The one true friend I thought I'd found. Tonight the bottle let me down. Every day, but the wine don't take effect the way it used to. And I'm hurting in an old familiar way. Tonight the bottle let me down.
The Hag with a interlude by The Cell, Joel Selvin, who contributed that that harmony there. I can hear from Kern River the sound of Merle Haggard rolling in his grave, by the way.
Merle took a shine to me. I don't know what I did to earn that, but yeah, we were pals in the latter years of his life.
Not a guy known for suffering fools or journalists.
You know,
which are one and the same thing to many musicians. But
he introduced me to Kris Kristofferson and says, "This guy writes just like Mark Twain." What the hell, man? Nobody's ever said that about me.
Wow. Great, great record again. It's one of those impossible to improve upon.
Well, and you can feel the Jim Gordon bounce.
Yeah.
Right? That's the key ingredient is the roll in the rock and roll, or the bounce in the middle that just it just trots everything along and you know, prods the whole thing into where it's going.
Well, we earlier played Pet Sounds, I'm Waiting for the Day, and I know this song, God Only Knows, we've all heard a gazillion times, but the percussion on this is very interesting, and until I read your book, I didn't even hear it, let alone know it was Jim Gordon doing it. So could you say...
Yeah, but you'll never hear it the same way again, will you?
Yeah, so enlighten our listeners. We're going to play God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, which I think he recorded, the day after he did the other track on Pet Sounds. They were giants in those days. But what's going on in percussion country on this particular record?
Well, Jim's on additional percussion on this session, and Hal Blaine's on the drum kit, and he's goofing around on a break with a plastic orange juice bottle, and he and Brian light on an idea. So Jim takes a razor blade and cuts four orange juice bottles and pitches them to different notes. And that is the additional percussion. It's sort of a clop, 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 clop. And it echoes Hal Blaine's drum part in a really unique way. I'm sorry, I shouldn't qualify unique. And you'll never, it's featured in the mix. And once you hear the orange juice bottles, you'll never unhear them.
And this is the mono mix, by the way, because we're purists here. If Brian Wilson could only hear out of one.
They really pop on the mono, yeah.
But again, just imagine, folks, the idea of tuning a plastic orange juice bottle to get a sound. And again, the genius in this room, you've got Hal Blaine, Jim Gordon, and of course, the maestro, Brian Wilson, who's picking all of this up with his one amazing bat ear and saying, yes, do that, and just knocking a record off like this.
always love you. But long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
So thanks a lot, Joel Selvin. I will never hear that classic record again without zeroing in on the clip clops and knowing that that is a tuned up orange juice, four orange juice bottles. It's amazing because, yes, you're right. It's so much a part of the record that you don't notice it's there, but when you're pointed out, there it is.
Well, it drives the track.
It does. And I just, you know, it's a clip clop, right? It's a clip clop sound and perfectly timed, perfectly played. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, there be giants, and Jim Gordon was one of them. You're listening to in the spot traditionally that holds What a Week from 11 to 12. This is a very special 2 hour and 10 minutes left to go, a deep dive into the amazing music of Jim Gordon. Jim Gordon's greatest hits, which pretty much encompass so many hits. And, you know, can you... Joel, we've been going for close to an hour now and haven't mentioned Layla yet, and I want to save Layla to the very end. If we can do a show where you say, well, we don't even have to deal with Layla, let's put that off till the end of the 3 hours. You know, you got a lot of good music in store. A question. I know Jim played on River Deep Mountain High over in Spectre Land. I'm not inclined to play that unless you can point out that we can hear Jim. I'm thinking...
Oh, there's no way. He's on a shaker or a maraca or something like that.
So he shoved way, way, way in the background.
Oh, well, that's the Phil Spector Sonics. So, no, you're not going to pick Jim out of a Phil Spector production. That's Earl Palmer on the kit there. I'm slamming it, by the way.
Yeah, amazing.
But, the Spectre liked that, that mulchy sound. He took that from the records produced by Frank Guida that you know of, like Gary U.S. Bonds and Jimmy Soul, If You Want to Be Happy. He had this sonics that were just all mulched together, and Spectre was very influenced by that.
That instant party.
He's got three keyboard players, two bass players, five guitarists and about six percussionists. So, nope.
Well, somehow when you're playing the Sonics of Brian Wilson, as we know, Brian was looking over his shoulder at all times at what Phil Spector was up to, and probably vice versa. And looking over at all of them was Lennon and McCartney, wondering in this kind of arms race of great music in the mid-60s, listening, we better up our game, boys. Have you heard this record, Pets? Didn't McCartney come into the studio for Pet Sounds? I think he actually was invited in to some of the sessions.
It was a little bit later. He's on a track on the Smiley Smile album called Vegetables.
Oh, really? He's on. Was that the recorded for Smile after, and then migrated over?
It was during the Smile sessions. Yeah.
Yeah. True story that if you're a fan of the movie Seconds, the John Frankenheimer film, which is the one of the most. When you do the Paranoia Film Festival, that's definitely one of the lead films. But folks, if you haven't seen it, it's a set black and white movie, 1966, so the plot being middle-aged guy gets plastic surgery to live an entirely different life. And you're 20 minutes into the movie before the bandages come off, and it's Rock Hudson. And it's this acid-infused, crazy, crazy movie that Brian Wilson apparently walked in to see by himself on LSD. And as he walks into the theater, the voice on the screen refers to the Rock Hudson character. "Hello, Mr. Wilson." Brian apparently freaks out, is convinced that Phil Spector had secretly made the movie to drive him insane. And that was what allegedly sort of led to some of the accelerant of the madness that would overtake the Smile sessions. Well, I'm digressing tremendously here, but...
Well, you know, Eric, Brian was schizophrenic too.
Well, definitely, had coped with and had his issues, and God bless him for working through them. What do you think of the movie where on Brian Wilson? We will get back to the topic at hand, which is Jim Gordon.
That latest thing that Jason did?
Love and Mercy. No, the movie Love and Mercy.
Oh, the Love and Mercy. That's with the Don Was soundtrack. That's pretty fun.
It's a good movie. Paul Dano plays young Brian, and it's set.
Oh, no, now we're talking the story movie.
Yeah, the story movie.
There's a concert movie called Love and Mercy.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah, that I like. Well, I like moments of it. I really hated The Long Promised Road. I thought that was an exploitation of somebody who was mentally ill.
I agree with you, and then that was, that happened, unfortunately has happened, and I don't have high hopes. I don't know if you know this, but there's a Mike Love-sanctioned Beach Boys documentary that's coming out.
They all signed off on it. All of them signed off on
it. I saw the trailer, though, which did not thrill me, and I know that there's three sound bites from Mike Love in there and nobody else. I'm not holding out a lot of hope for it, but then I am a born cynic and skeptic, so there's that.
Yeah, but you'll watch every minute of it.
Oh, I know. I'll get to wait for the long cut to come out on Blu-ray and look at the outtakes. To me, it's right into that. Well, we're broadcasting here on this fine, fine radio station, KSQD Santa Cruz and KSQT Prunedale. I slipped an ID in there. And one of Santa Cruz's great musical legends was a group of surfers called the Tikis. And Joel, you know where I'm heading here. Tell me the story of the Tikis and Jim Gordon and Lenny Wan. We're going into Warner Brothers country here, so and we want to shout out the Tikis.
The Tikis were on a San Francisco independent label called Autumn Records. It was run by a couple of disc jockeys, Tom Donahue and Bobby Mitchell. And when they got out of the record business, they sold everything to Warner Brothers. And so Warner Brothers picked up the Bo Brummels, the Vegetables, the Mojo Men, and the Tikis. Not exactly like Big Score, but there they had these groups. And the Tikis went into the studio with Lenny Warnock, 25 years old. His father owned Liberty Records. So he sort of grew up in the business. But he was just starting out at Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers at that point, pretty square, not very hip. Didn't have a lot of records on the charts. It was Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bill Cosby albums and Sinatra, of course. So Lenny had an uphill battle there. And he brought the Tiki singers in anyway to the studio with a bunch of the session players, including Van Dyke Parks, who was brilliant. His next-door neighbor growing up was Randy Newman, and Randy did the arrangements on a lot of the Tiki's records, but the band didn't want to put the record out under the name of the Tiki's because, well, they thought they had a constituency back in Santa Cruz.
As they did, you know. And, I mean, you don't mess around with the Tiki's here in Santa Cruz. Just want to tell you, there's still some.
So they called them Harper's Bazaar, and the first record was pretty much a top 10 hit. I think it got to 11. But that was a big showing for Warner Brothers, and that was the beginning of Lenny Warnker's career as a producer, which would get on to be pretty epic before he was done.
Well, Paul Simon, the writer of this song, was on. Did a really great the long form interviews worth checking out a couple weeks ago with Stephen Colbert, and singled this song out as maybe his least favorite least favorite song he ever wrote. So let's see.
Well, Lenny knew the song, and what he wanted to do was kind of make it into a Good Vibrations-like thing. He just heard that record, and he brought Leon Russell, who was a really popular session musician at that point, into like, you know, juice up the arrangement.
So imagine, so you've got Randy Newman, Van Dyke Parks, Leon Russell, and of course Jim Gordon on drums, all swirling around Santa Cruz's beloved Tiki's, playing Paul Simon's least favorite composition. Santa Cruz's beloved Tiki. So you're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale. So I'm here with Joel Selvin, celebrating the life and music and a tragic end, or the tragic arc of great drummer Jim Gordon's life. I have to say, listening to that brings me back. So 11-year-old me, in my latchkey days, my mother had like 5 records, and one of them was the Harper's Bazaar record that had Anything Goes on it and Chattanooga Choo Choo. And I remember seeing that movie Seconds in a theater. Like somehow she went to see it, and 11-year-old me saw it. And that pretty much had not quite the experience that Brian Wilson had with it, but enough so it sort of made me who I am today. And I'm not completely happy with that whole arc there. But what a great record, right?
his way. But yeah, that's the beginning of sort of the West Coast pop thing. And, you know, in a couple of years, that would be the Mamas and Papas and Beach Boys and all that kind of stuff. But you can hear the good vibrations in that.
Oh, yeah. And it's just so beautifully arranged and, let's dare I say, overproduced. It's the kind of music I'm not surprised that my mother had. You know what I mean? Because it's not scary, but it's nice and light and lively. Well, we're getting into the second hour now of Jim Gordon's work, and speaking of music that was packaged for the masses, and I'm speaking, of course, about the real Prefab Five, the Monkees. The song "Mary Mary" has Jim's like all over that song, and was this? I'm sure just another punch the clock, go in the studio and out of the studio, but give us a little perspective on the Monkees and where they fit in this sort of Southern California music scene, besides being extravagantly wildly rich and partying with the likes of Stephen Stills and having Jimi Hendrix as an opening act. What other Monkees lore do you have for us?
Well, first of all, there's no punching the clock for these guys. These are heroes, Eric, and session musicians are like, you know, jousting knights. And when they go into the ring, they give their best every time to serve the song and to serve the artist. So I don't really feel like, you know, punch the clock. No. And the Monkees were a big project. They had to do songs for an entire season. And I think there was a number of songs on each show. They had to do two albums, and they had to get it all done before the premiere of the TV series. And they had to shoot the TV series at the same time they were doing these records. There was a whole mishigash behind, like, who was going to be in charge of producing the records. Like, Carole King took a crack at it, and it didn't work out for her. And Leon Russell took a crack at it, and it didn't work out for him. But they brought in these guys that had their own band. So most of the Monkees' tracks are these Candy Store Profits was the name of their group. But they brought in the guys, and Campbell's on it, and Burton's on it, and Jim's on it, and Hal's on it, and it, you know, because there was just so much work to do all those numbers and in such a short period of time. So the Monkees were a big project in early 1967 in Los Angeles recording studios. And Jim was a part of it, in and out, but the Mary Mary track is his, you know, stellar moment. And what a song, you know? I mean, that's kind of hard edge for the Monkees. There's a good version of it on the Paul Butterfield Blues Band album.
Is this a Boyce and Hart song, or do you know who wrote this?
I don't know who wrote Mary Mary. I don't think it's Boyce and Hart, but they were the producers.
The Monkees, ladies and gentlemen, and this goes out to David Bean, who worked closely with Mike Nesmith across the bay in Monterey. David, if you're listening, I hope Mike would have a smile listening. Hope this is one of the Monkees records that Mike liked. You know, Mike could be a bit Mike could be a bit picky. We'll be right back. The Monkees, Mary Mary. Yeah, Jim Gordon is definitely all over that.
Nesmith wrote that.
Ah, there we go. So and no wonder I predicted that Nesmith would like us playing that particular song. It's a great song, too. Well, it's a little off color, but not really. I met a monkey. Okay, I know this will really impress you, Joel, because you've never, of course, met any famous rock stars. But I was at a screening at the Directors Guild and something in Los Angeles, and I went into the men's room. It was just me and Mickey Dolenz. And I realized, Mickey Dolenz, and I had turned over to him as we were doing our thing. Is, you know, Mickey, I really love Head. And then I realized as he was edging away from me, no, I didn't mean it like that, Mickey. But I digress, as I want to do now the Grateful Dead Zone. We've crossed over into the Grateful Dead Zone country. If you're just tuning in and you're a deadhead, well, we didn't. We mentioned Autumn Records and Tom Donahue, and one of Autumn Records, I think, signees was, I think the Warlocks were on Autumn before they became the Dead. I'm pretty sure the Dead.
They did a session, but nobody liked it, and the Dead didn't like it, and the company didn't like it. So.
You mentioned Dave Hassinger producing the Rolling Stones at RCA Studios. That's where, when the Jefferson Airplane did Surrealistic Pillow, they brought Jerry Garcia down to interpret for them, because the Airplane wanted to do certain things, but they knew they couldn't possibly articulate it. And Dave Hassinger is famously the engineer who, when Bob Weir, I think in the Oxymoxoa session, said he wanted the sound of heavy air. And that's when Hassinger rips off his headphones and stalks away and says, "That's it. I'm not working with these guys again. I'm done." So,
He engineered their first album. He had a reputation based on his work at RCA and Cut and Satisfaction that I think sort of exceeded, you know, his real abilities. There were a lot of people working where he did that, you know, like Richie Podlor and Bill Cooper, that were really good and never got the recognition. But Hassinger was hot for a while.
Yeah, definitely. But heavy air, Bob Weir, ladies and gentlemen. So we're diving deep into the music of the great Jim Gordon. We're in the L.A. years. Not that he hasn't gone to England yet. And boy, do we have some greatest hits to come. We have to make sure we don't play so many obscurities. We don't play the greatest hits. But you had a record that I did not know that Jim Gordon played on, and we're in that Glen Campbell, John Hartford, writer of Gentle on My Mind, was Mason Williams' greatest hit. In fact, wouldn't it safe to say his only hit? But what a hit it was. And of course now, Jim Gordon is all over that. Can you I'm hinting here. I won't give the title of the song, but giving the title of the song, but tell people what to listen for. How's that?
This is really a Mike Post record, okay? Mason Williams had a little guitar number, and Mike Post was assigned to produce it. Of course, Mike and Jim started out in high school together in the music business.
Tell our listeners about Mike Post, though. We know who he is, but...
he was in high school with Jim, and they were in a band together before Jim went off to be the Everly Brothers, and Post went on to become a writer and producer. He had some success with Just Dropped In to See What My Condition Is. The First Edition.
First Edition, Kenny Rogers, yes. He became The Gambler.
But this record really solidified Post's reputation. It won the Grammy for the Best Arrangement. It was a 28-piece session call, and originally it was just a little guitar number. So what it became was Mike Post's work, and Jim is in the dead center of this.
And the thing was, it was Jim's in the center of it, but it was seen as Mike Post's folly because it cost so much to do. Wasn't this one of those things where studio record guys were looking, saying, "Really, huh?"
Oh yeah, and Tommy Smothers said it was, you know, the worst piece of, you know, that he ever heard, and then, you know, changed his mind the next day. No, nobody'd ever heard a record sound like this before.
And to be pretty fair, I think nobody's heard many records since that sound like this.
Thank you.
Safe to say Tommy Smothers was wrong. Eh, Joel Selvin?
It's an amazing piece. And of course, Post went on to become the king of the TV themes. And Jim it just is killer on the Rockford Files. He worked all the Andy Williams show when Post was the musical director. And they had a long and fruitful association.
Well, and again, we're zeroing in on L.A. because Jim Gordon, you know, L.A. at that point was, if not the epicenter of popular music, but pretty darn close. And Jim Gordon was the backbeat of so many of these amazing records. And we're doing a deep dive into the music of Jim Gordon, picking it apart both before and after. And we'll tell more about, we haven't even gotten near Derek and the Dominoes yet, or George Harrison yet, or I even have a Barbara Streisand in Strategic Reserve, Joel Selvin. And this is all, if you're just tuning in or you're listening in, Joel has written the book, Drums and Demons. Jim Gordon was, if anyone knows of him at all, it's, oh, yeah, the guy who killed his mother. Ooh, and had eyes roll. And it's obscured just the incredible music that he created during his life. And you mentioned in the first hour, but it's important to mention again that the demons that drove him, his illness, his schizophrenia, you really believe is his. It also drove his musicality, and they overlapped. And when he was behind that drum set, he could fight the demons off. As long as he was playing, he could quiet the voices in his head.
Well, playing drums is not like playing violin or trumpet. Every time you strike a drum kit, you feel it in every cell of your body. So the combination of the report and the rhythmic entrainment of the groove, it's just an encompassing thing. It just fills your entire being. And if you're Jim Gordon, and you've lived in that realm of rhythm since you were a kid, and it's this safe place where you can go and be just monstrous, just be fantastic at what you do. The ability to precisely divide and reallocate time is not something you can teach. You can teach some of it, but so much of what Jim brings to every time he plays drums comes from intuition and an ability that goes beyond musical notation. So this is a kind of genius drummer who was gifted with something that other people just didn't have.
And he was a prodigal gift. And, you know, how did he, you know, we've now going back to the beginning, but he was born to be a drummer in some ways.
He found the drums when he was about 8 years old. By the time he was in high school, he was taking lessons from two different teachers in the San Fernando Valley and going over the hill to UCLA, where his instructor was sending him home with four mallet Bach homework on the keyboards. He could play all the mallet instruments. He could read like crazy. He guested with the Burbank Symphony before he was out of high school. He belonged to a 45-piece marching band that toured Europe for the State Department when he was still in high school. So by the time he went out with the Everly Brothers, he was a completely trained drummer. But that just, I mean, there's a lot of people with training. What Jim brought to the drums was way beyond his training.
He brought in genius. And the way he looked, too, he was like he looked like what Brian Wilson probably wanted to look like, you know, a blonde surfer god. You know, he's incredibly handsome, charismatic. You know, he was the entire deal, too. And by all accounts, certainly in these early formative years, a good guy to have around. I mean, people liked him, would you not say? At least
The people loved Jim. When I told Van Dyke Parks that I was doing this book, he said, oh, Jim was the esprit de corps. So he was very well liked. And, you know, he had this blonde California girl wife who was a professional dancer. She was on the Dick Clark show, Where the Action Is. They were making huge amounts of money before they were able to vote. And
he had the big valley house, right?
They had a wonderful life going. And
one daughter, correct?
Yeah, one daughter and Amy, who's grown and living in Europe now.
Well, we'll circle back on Amy and Jill in a little later. But, you know, we talk about geniuses who are bordering, I won't say mental illness, but geniuses who are wired differently than most normal people and have channeled that wiring into genius. The name Neil Young comes to mind. And I did not know that Neil Young played on this record. And you get into the making of it to some degree. And another guy who is wired a little differently is Jack Nitzsche. So if you can tell our listeners a bit about the Jim Gordon, Jack Nitzsche, Neil Young convergence. And we're looking, 1967. So it is the alleged summer of love, and these guys collide. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Nitzsche was Phil Spector's arranger. He well knew.
Speaking of crazy people, but do go on.
Yeah, Nitzsche well knew Jim. He did Everly Brothers sessions, and then it brought him into Phil Spector sessions. So they had been associated for several years by that time. Neil Young was in and out of Buffalo Springfield, and there was a point where he was out, and he played a song to Nitzsche, who flipped out for it and wanted to record it. Took Neil into the studio. This is Neil Young's first solo recording session. He was so nervous, it took days to record the vocal, almost line by line. But Nitzsche just brought in the guys and the guys and Carole Kaye, and Jim was on drums, and I forget who else is on him. Don Randy, I think, is on it. I know Carole's on it. Tommy Tedesco's on it, and of all people, Russ Titelman, who was a high school friend of Lenny Warnaker's, who was writing and producing records at that point.
And Titelman's part of the Warner Brothers Mafia, right? You got Warnaker.
Yeah, he was circulating around there. But so this was a Neil Young solo track. But then before they could do anything with it, Neil Young's back in Buffalo Springfield. So it wound up on the last Buffalo Springfield album.
And Neil Young has always been Neil Young. You know, he's always been mercurial. He's always followed his artistic muse. He's backtracked and doubled back and drove everyone around him crazy because he pursues his dream. So I love that he records this for his solo record and then steals it back for the Buffalo Springfield. And then they break up again. And then they have one more album. And then they finally break up permanently until they do the reunion a few years ago that they're going to do, and then Neil Young changes his mind again. Do you see a pattern here in Joel Self? Anyway.
Like you say, Neil does what he wants to do when he wants to do it.
We've all heard this song, but I bet you didn't know that Jim Gordon was the drummer.
Tried so hard to stand, but as I stumbled and fell to the ground. So hard to laugh as I fumbled and reached for the love I found. Was gone. If I ever lived without you, now you know I've gone. If I ever said I loved you, now you know I've
KSQD thanks Meals on Wheels Salinas Valley for supporting this program. Meals on Wheels annual fundraiser is the Wine Lovers Drawing. Your ticket provides a chance to win a wagon filled with wines and tastings from Bernardus, Dawn's Dream, Galante, Morgan, McIntyre, and a Taste of Monterey, wine accessories, and more. Drawing held May 30th. Tickets for the drawing at 831-758-6325 or mowsalinas.org. Thank you, Meals on Wheels of Salinas Valley, for supporting K-Squid, 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM.
This would be KSQD, and if you're just tuning in and you're expecting the Grateful Dead Zone, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed, but then again, you will be exalted. So instead of the Grateful Dead Zone, I'm here with the extraordinary writer Joel Selvin, and if you've ever picked up a copy of the San Francisco Chronicle between 1972 and the new millennium, you'll be familiar with his byline and his expertise on all things Bay Area music. But clearly you've widened your purview to, the subject of today's three-hour special, Drums and Demons, your new book on the great drummer Jim Gordon. And once you start hearing Jim Gordon, like I've heard Expecting to Fly maybe 10,000 times in my life, but after reading your book, you can hear that's Jim Gordon. You definitely can hear him at work.
I've listened to so many Jim Gordon records now that I can pick it out without any trouble. He's got such a touch and such a signature to the way he approaches dividing time up that it's just obvious when you once you tumble to the sound of it.
Well, I'm going to jump a little forward here, but we're in Neil Young country, and I made a oblique reference to Stephen Stills, who apparently auditioned to be in the Monkees, but he had his crooked teeth, and he wasn't quite photogenic enough. I wonder which monkey he would have been, though, the cute one, I can't imagine Stephen Stills. He'd been the military school martinet monkey, maybe. I don't know. It's tough to figure out. But again, until I read your book, I did not know that he played on the first Crosby, Stills and Nash album. I really did think that was Dallas Taylor. Any background on that?
Dallas Taylor hooked up with those guys. They'd already started recording, and they had this track in the can, they needed a drummer.
And is there a drummer in the house? And then yeah. Jim Gordon was the drummer in the house, and on this particular song, again, you've heard it a gazillion times, but on drums, Jim Gordon.
Sunset in your eyes, juggling the train through clear Moroccan skies. Ducks and pigs and chickens call, animal carpet wall to wall. American ladies 5 foot tall and blue, sweeping cobwebs.
webs from the edges of my mind. Had to get away to see what we could find. Hope the days that lie ahead bring us back to where they've led. Listen not to what's been said to you.
Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? You know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express. They're taking me to Marrakesh. All on board the train. All on board the train.
I've been saving all my money just to take you there. I smell the garden in your Casablanca blowing sound. Blowing smoke rings from the corners of my mouth. Colored cockles hang in the air. Charming cobras in the square. Stretch your levers, we can wear at home.
Well, let me hear you now.
Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh. Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh. All on board the train. All on board the train. All on
And if I recall, Jim Gordon, after doing that session, said, hey, these guys are going to make it, I think. Am I not cutting?
His wife remembered him coming home and saying, hey, these guys are great. This is a hit record.
Yeah, and he was,
it must have been nice to have that in your hip pocket when you start the recording sessions for your album.
We certainly get adjusted. I'm assuming it's Jim Gordon and Stephen Stills on Everything Else, probably.
Probably a fair
bit. Captain Many Hands, as he was known. So we're in, it's funny how you just sort of move in. We're covering a lot of L.A. ground, and we're now fellow travelers of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And Cass Elliott certainly played a huge role in, there's the ongoing debate of, and it's no one can seem to agree. I know this will shock you, Joel Selvin, that Crosby, Stills, and Nash can't agree on something, but where they first heard, where they first sang. There's a story that it was in Joni Mitchell's house, and there's another story that it was at Cass Elliott's. And I think Stills is in the Cass Elliott school, and Nash and Crosby, I think, were in the Joni Mitchell's place. But let's just say Cass Elliott's place had a lot of great parties in Laurel. The ones that weren't at Peter Tork's place, because remember, Peter Tork basically spent his monkey money on a great spread, and it was Party Central there up in Laurel Canyon for quite some time, just trying to sketch the musical scene. And lurking in the wings is Frank Zappa, who's in the movie Head, the movie that I brought up to Mickey Dolenz in an inappropriate fashion. And Frank Zappa is going to play a role in Jim Gordon's career, maybe in our next hour. I'm not too sure. But let's talk about Cass Elliott and, the record I'm going to play, Joel. Any interesting tidbits about Jim, Cass Elliott, her role as kind of the matriarch? I mean, a woman, everybody loved her. Just everybody.
Yeah, she was the Pearl Mesta of Laurel Canyon, if I can make it. Well, I don't know what record you're playing. Which one are you playing?
California Earthquake.
Oh, good. Yeah. Jim was on the sessions with producer John Simon. And when I asked Simon about it, all he could do was complain about Cass having been strung out on heroin.
Really?
Yeah, that was his take on this stuff. He didn't really think the records were very good, and he didn't think the vocal performances were very good, but,
Well, what does John Simon know? He only produced music from Big Pink and, I think, the band's Brown album, so he doesn't have any expertise in music producing now, does he? But he wrote a book, too, I think. I read his memoir. He's one of those guys, not to be confused with Paul Simon. This is John Simon, the producer. And Jim, I think, did he tour with her? I know he did some TV shows with Castle.
Well, later on, there was a personal association with Cass and Jim, a brief affair, I guess you'd call it. And during that period of time, he was working in Chicago with her on a live album. And he also bounced to Miami and did a series of dates down there with him. I don't know how long it lasted, a couple months maybe.
Well, in this this is, as we mentioned, California Earthquake, and Jim Gordon definitely brings the seismic percussive magic to this particular record by Cass Elliott. Love those sound effects at ends of records. Yeah, that definitely, Jim is definitely a major, major player in that. California Earthquake, Cass Elliott. You're listening to Eric Nelson in the space formerly known as the Grateful Dead Zone, but this is a special on the great percussive madness in music of Jim Gordon with Joel Selvin. Next week, though, you never fear, it's going to be a supersized Grateful Dead Zone during our pledge drive with Henry Kaiser joining me to play, what Henry Kaiser thinks is Jerry Garcia's greatest solos with the Grateful Dead. And Joel, I think you'd attest if Henry Kaiser thinks something is good musically, he knows of what he speaks.
I would be very interested in hearing what Henry comes up with. Very.
Well, stay tuned to next week, but let's go on. So interesting how this art imitates life, life imitates art, and the kind of soap opera of L.A. Music. We've talked about Stephen Stills, a.k.a. Captain Many Hands. We brought up Richard Thompson earlier, who came over with Henry Kaiser to your house at 9 o'clock to watch those Ricky Nelson But those are all lip-synced, though, right? I don't think there was actually live shooting James Burton actually playing the solo we see him do in those. But
actually, some are and some aren't.
Well, there you go. But anyway, this is a huge digression, but if you've listened to the entire show. But it all kind of came together, the world of Richard Thompson, Stephen Stills, James Burton, and Jim Gordon on Judy Collins' Who Knows Where the Time Goes album, which covered Sandy Denny's great song. She Must Have Heard It off of Unhalf Bricking, which Richard Thompson plays beautifully on. Give me a little background into those sessions. And, you know, that really was the pinnacle. I really believe that was Judy Collins's best record, with the exception of some of the ones she's come out with in the last 5 years, which are terrific. Judy Collins has really made, speaking of hitting it out of the park, her last few studio releases have been really awfully good. But this is 1969. Stephen Stills is 68?
Yeah, I think so. No, it's 69. You're right.
Because
it's June. It's right when his daughter was born. His daughter was born during the sessions.
Right. And we talked about Crosby, Stills, and Nash's first album with Marrakesh Express, and the opening song, Sweet Judy Blue Eyes, written by a smitten Stephen Stills for Judy Collins. So I think we've gotten what, if you're a listener of the Grateful Dead Zone, we've got serious synchronicity, man, going on here. So give us a little background on
a novice record producer, a well-known hip guy named David Anderley, landed the Judy Collins assignment, and she'd made records in New York and it was a well-known thing, but you know, she never worked with anybody like session musicians like this. So she came out to Los Angeles, and Anderley put together a band, James Burton and Stephen Stills on guitar, Chris Etheridge from the Flying Burrito Brothers on bass, Van Dyke Parks on keyboards, Jim on drums, Buddy Emmons from the Roger Miller Band on pedal steel guitar. And what they did was essentially just create a sound of their own. I call it in the book chamber pop. Yeah, no, Judy Collins never seen anything like it. Who had seen anything like it, really? Amazing record. But then at the end, they needed that radio track, right? And Stills and Collins, who were starting their romance, hit on the old Ian and Sylvia song, Someday Soon, brought it into the sessions. And Jim just did the Merle Haggard thing, you know, cross hands and dot, dot, dot. And that was the Judy Collins' big hit record.
And in the fine tradition of never playing what people expect, I'm not going to play Someday Soon, even though I love that song. I was going to play the title track to this.
That's Jim's favorite. You know, there are very few interviews with Jim Gordon, but he brings this up in a drum magazine interview as like something that he wanted to represent himself with. And that's so interesting because this is not show-off drumming, right? This is ensemble playing.
Well, James Burton's guitar solo, or not even a solo, is percussive tick, tick, tick on Someday Soon is one of my favorite James Burton licks, and it's just so understated. Something that Richard Thompson certainly was channeling, you know, listening to James Burton, is knowing what not to play. And on that Someday Soon, James Burton definitely knows what not to play. But because we can only play one track off of one album, I think we'll go with the song that Jim Gordon said is if not pinnacle as a studio musician, the one that he'd be appreciative that we're playing it now. Don't you agree?
Yeah, this is something that he pointed to in picking out records that he was proud of being on.
Time for them to go.
Another word comes to mind when you hear music like that is sympathetic. Jim's so sympathetic to what's going on, you know, along with all the other musicians, just sort of dialing it in and broadcasting it out. You know what I'm saying, Joel?
He's an ensemble player, and that's a fantastic ensemble. They found their own sound, and they suited it to both the material and the vocalists. And it's just a beautiful piece.
It really is, you know, and it's tough to improve on the original, and I don't think it improves on the original, but it matches it, you know, the beautiful Half Brick Inc. Sandy Denny version with Richard, I think 19-year-old Richard Thompson on lead guitar on that, totally refined and restrained, and then this beautiful version. I always wondered, I don't know what Sandy Denny's reaction to it, other than being very happy to get the royalties for that song recording, but never.
Well, and she was not well known at the time, and that piece was not well known. The Fairport thing was, you know, very sort of cultish, if that.
I mean, well, they hadn't come, you know, Fairport was just. Had, you know, obviously horrific, truly horrific, tragic luck. You know, they had their first real album, What We Did on Our Holidays, and then on Half Bricking, and then with Richard at the wheel, that auto accident that kills Richard's girlfriend and their drummer, Martin Lamble, after on Half Bricking, which prevents them from coming over to tour the U.S., and then they reform 1969 for Legion Leaf. And then Richard, I think the one and only Fairport tour was in the spring of 1970 with Richard. And then Richard's knack for career oblivion, then he leaves the band, of course, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We digress, though, on this thing, but it's, you know, important to put into context. Harry Nilsson, I did not know, again, so many things I did not know about Jim Gordon and is what he played on until I read your fantastic book, Drums and Demons, on Jim Gordon, Joel Selvin. But this track, I'm trying not to give away the title. I think you know the one, the hit that Jim Gordon played on. But Harry Nielsen's going to crop up. He's sort of a peripheral character as we start getting into the debauchery, the early 70s heroin and debauchery days of certainly the Beatles, et cetera, et cetera.
Jim and Harry were buddies. He played on a ton of Harry's records. And, you know, they were carousing pals in Los Angeles and London.
Well, and that's the thing. This is where we're starting to get into, you know, the drug years, and the drugs are taking their toll. There's certain combinations that are not a good idea. Brian Wilson doing LSD, very bad idea. And
really, you think so?
Yeah,
I think that's where California Girls comes from.
Yeah, well, you know what?
I have this thing about, I don't think the drugs were the problem. Brian was mentally ill. I don't think the drugs were the problem with Jim. I think the drugs helped Jim.
You think so? That. I mean, that's as the host of the Grateful Dead Zone, you're never going to hear me make anti-drug messages. I would sort of be preaching against my choir here. But, you know, he was self-medicating, and in case of Jim Gordon, definitely self-medicating to just try to quiet the voices in his head.
I think alcohol was his most effective coping tool.
Interesting. And he kept it up, and again, when he was trying to dig himself out or try to still the voices in his head, it got even more out of control, which we'll be getting to in the third part of our 3-hour special. But let's play. This is a song, again, I did not know that Jim is on. And again, if you dial in, anything on the drumming we should listen for? I think you know the track I'm going to do. I want to sort of semi-surprise our listeners here as to what we're going to play.
This is, you know, this is understated, elegant stuff.
And
you know, one of the greatest vocals in pop music history.
Yeah, there is that.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare. I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me. Can't hear a word they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
I'm walking here, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was on that Nielsen record and was picked for the soundtrack. I don't think it was done originally for the...
That's correct.
Originally for the soundtrack. You're listening to a special 3-hour, and now we only have 1 hour left, and I will say... quite honestly, I think we may be saving the best for last as we get
into... Yeah, I can't believe we've only got an hour left, whereas I know what we haven't played.
Yeah, the earth has cooled considerably since we started this show. But as we talked about casual drug use a few minutes ago, and you brought up some points, and I know I'm preaching to my Grateful Dead audience here. I thought we'd go out. I did not know... that Jim Gordon played on this Arlo Guthrie song.
He's fabulous on it. I love the fills into the chorus on this.
Yeah, my theory is there's basically no great record came out between 1965 and 1975 that Jim Gordon didn't play on. It's a tough one, but this song goes out for all you casual drug abusers out there, which means the entirety of the Grateful Dead Zone audience, and we'll... Well, let's just let Arlo take it away.
Coming in from London, from over the pole, flying in a big airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. Could we ever feel much? Touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man. Yeah, and here's a guy with a ticket to Mexico. No, he couldn't look much stranger. Walking in a hall with his things and all, smiling, said he was the Lone Ranger. Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man. On the escalator, there's a man in the line and she's blowing his mind, thinking that he's already made her. Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man. Coming in from London, from over the airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. Could we ever feel much finer? Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man.
This is Paul Hine, and I'm one of the hosts of the weekly music show, Runs on Grasoline. If you like bluegrass, folk, and Americana music, tune in to KSQD 90.7 FM, Saturdays at 2 p.m. Runs on Grasoline, here on K-Squid, community radio for the Monterey Bay Area.
KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM. KSQT Prunedale, 89.7 FM and translator K208GE Monterey, 89.5 FM.
Did you get all that, Joel? There'll be a short quiz at the end of the next hour. You're listening to KSQD, the aforementioned KSQD. I'm with Joel Selvin, and we're in the final hour of a three-hour. And if you just tuned in and you've missed the first 2 hours, it is on our two-week archive as of tomorrow. Just click on What a Week and then on the Grateful Dead Zone. It's cleverly disguised as two different shows, but you can catch up if you've missed, and you have missed if you're just tuning in, some great music from the great drummer Jim Gordon. But I would be remiss if I did not mention other great things on this radio station, and that would be tomorrow at 5 o'clock, tomorrow being Sunday, if you're keeping score, Sustainability Now. And that's going to feature a conversation with Eve Bratman, a professor of environmental studies at Franklin and Marshall College. And this is about bees. And bees, if you're keeping up with a Washington Post article, are having something of a comeback due to farming. But this book is about the politics of saving the aforementioned bees and the ethics of a sustainable future. So if you want to tune in and find out all about the way that human society fumbles along as it tries to protect bees and why we want to protect those little winged critters, that would be tomorrow at 5 o'clock on Sustainability Now. So, Joel, we're now moving into the 70s, and I think we're ready, if not for the hit, which we'll probably save for later and not play at all because we've only heard it a gazillion times. It's Derek and the Dominoes. So how does Jim Gordon, the Mighty Main Man drummer, hook up with Eric Clapton, Delaney and Bonnie, that whole ecosystem of musicians? This we're now in kind of into 69, 70 now.
Well, late 69, the center of the music scene had shifted from the hit records of 66 and even 67 to the stage. I mean, Led Zeppelin was touring that fall. They were doing a 2.5-hour show with a half-hour drum solo. The Who had Tommy, and they were doing that around the country. The Rolling Stones were back on the stage. So Jim had had enough of being a session musician. He'd done everything you can do. Made a lot of money, and he played on every kind of record he wanted to, and he was hungry to move into this realm because that's what was happening. Got involved sitting in with Delaney and Bonnie and Friends, which was a band put together by Leon Russell, featuring a couple of Southern soul singers that he liked, and he put that band together. And Jim sort of wrangled his way into the drum chair. They went on tour. They weren't a really popular band with the public, but musicians loved them. And George Harrison.
Yeah, I was about to say, I know one musician who would certainly love them.
Yeah, he wanted to sign them to Apple Records, but they'd already been signed to Elektra. He played the tape for Eric Clapton, his best friend, and Clapton ended up putting him on as the opening act for Blind Faith, the band he did with Stevie Winwood and Ginger Baker on their U.S. tour. And bit by bit, an unhappy Clapton who hated Blind Faith got more and more attracted to the opening act. And by the end of the tour, he was sitting in every night with Delaney and Bonnie and Friends. So they backed him on a European tour. Jim plays his ass off on the Delaney and Bonnie live record. Then Cocker stole the Delaney and Bonnie, or I say Leon Russell, stole the Delaney and Bonnie rhythm section for Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Which is not just Gordon, it's Jim Gordon and Jim Keltner. So you're talking about
Chuck Blackwell, and there were so many drummers in that band, but Keltner and Gordon, with Gordon holding down the beat, Keltner was the pulse. About 2 weeks after he got back from that tour, he flew into London to join a band that Clapton was starting with a couple guys from Delaney and Bonnie, Carl Radel on bass and Bobby Whitlock on keyboards. They had a charity gig booked like 4 days later, 5 days later. So they threw that together, did the charity gig. That's where they picked up the name Derek and the Dominoes, because they didn't have a name. And about 2 days after that, they went into the studio to back up George Harrison. The first track they did was What Is Life? And Jim charges into that track with so much excitement, so much confidence, so much command. You could just feel him charging into George Harrison's music and the highest realm of rock music at the time.
You know what?
And, you know, he was there for a couple weeks. Ringo had been doing the sessions, and then Ringo came back, and they gave him a tambourine.
Well, I think the FCC will revoke our license to play music if we don't play What Is Life after that introduction. What do you think? So let's, yeah, as you say, he takes over with authority. And this would be the 2020 mix. So if the mix is different, Joel, than you've heard, blame whoever remixed this thing 4 years ago. But this is Jim Gordon with George Harrison. No doubt that Jim Gordon is, in fact, driving that musical train. So you're absolutely right, Joel Selvin, about that. What Is Life? All Things Must Pass, still probably the greatest Beatles solo album, though I'm sure it would be a lot of debates among Beatlemaniacs about that. But maybe about it is it's the best longest solo album. At this point in his career, he is truly in the rock royalty fastest lane one can get in, right? Clapton, Harrison, Lennon, going to Saint-Tropez for Mick Jagger's wedding, correct? I mean, this is this is rock and roll, true royalty here. And but the wheels are sort of starting to come off for Jim as far as snapping. You can't gloss over the fact that he's a hitter. Domestic violence, you know, he lashed out at girlfriends, Rita Coolidge, memorably. This is he's starting to come apart in a violent, abusive fashion.
Those were fissures. It wasn't like a Ike Turner kind of thing where he was using violence to control someone. They were explosions, the eruptions that were as surprising to Jim, I'm sure, as they were to his victims. It was something, like you say, the internal turbulence was beginning to build up so that there were these things that like spiked out of it. And then Derek and the Dominoes, those guys, you couldn't use more drugs than they did.
Well, we're going to play. This is about traditionally in the Grateful Dead zone, Joel, where we kind of follow the rhythms of a Grateful Dead first and second set. And we're about to, this would be about at the time where we would go into a more spacey, leisurely jam portion. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to play Derek and the Dominoes live. And I've always loved, this was, I think, the lead track on their In Concert record, which came out not too far after the breakup. It was from concerts at the Fillmore, I think, in what, November of 69? I'm trying to remember when that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. So this would be Jim Gordon alive. This isn't a 20-minute long Dark Star. No, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Deadheads. This is 9 minutes and 29, but it's longer than we've usually gone on this retrospective. But I think, Joel, wouldn't you agree? If you want to hear the man live, you got to hear the man live. And
When Jim was playing on recording sessions, it was surgical, scientific work that was designed to make this song into a hit record. When he got out on the stage, now instead of being under a microscope, he's got a broadcast. So he had entirely different drummer out there with Mad Dogs and Delaney and Derek and the Dominoes, just exploding in all directions at once.
And with all due apologies to Lou Reed, this is, I think, what heroin sounds like.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, I'm not saying Clapton is God, but Joel Selvin, you'd agree, at least on that recording, he's a somewhat of a lesser deity, but a deity nonetheless.
I just think the Derek and the Dominoes thing was just an apex of the whole sort of classic rock era.
No.
It never fails to amaze me.
Yeah, and that track, that particular version of that particular song, even when you take Duane Allman out of the mix, it's still phenomenal. And Clapton, again, whatever drugs they're doing, can I have some of them? I must say.
Well, it occurred to me the other day that having Duane Allman bump into Eric Clapton for 5 days in Miami was something like Miles Davis and John Coltrane doing Kind of Blue.
But the thing, of course, about, and we're talking about the Layla Sessions. This is a special on Jim Gordon, drummer. I'm with Joel Selvin, music critic extraordinaire and author of the book Drums and Demons on Jim Gordon. But Miles and Coltrane had played together and were in the same musical tradition and knew of one another's work, as Clapton knew Allman. But the serendipity of Clapton being in Miami, finding out that the Allman Brothers were playing a concert, going to the gig, a daytime outdoor concert, and Allman looks down probably midway through Whipping Post and sees Eric Clapton sitting there and completely freezes up. And then Clapton being just Mr. Generous, hey, come on down to the studio and check us out. Or I think Allman actually asked Tom Dowd, he said, do you think, would Eric mind if I drop by the session? And the rest, as they say, is history. Nope, put on that guitar, you're sitting in. And the magic emerged. Ah, rock and roll, great stories. Let's talk about a lesser-known story that you get into, and this would be Richard Perry and Carly Simon trying to make a hit. This is, what, 1972? So Jim Gordon, after Derek and the Dominoes falls apart, he tours, I think then he goes out with Traffic. Am I correct? Right after Derek and the Dominoes, or was that before? So he goes out with Traffic, and he comes back, and he's doing Back in the Session mold adjustment. And Richard Perry, another one of those headstrong producers, we've met a few of them in the course of this 3 hours, is trying to get Carly Simon of the Simon & Schuster dynasty to get a hit record out of her. So why don't you take it from there, Joel?
Well, they'd been working on this track all week. They'd had first Carly's drummer, Andy Newmark, took a crack at it, and then they brought in a session player from England, and then Jim was in town with a night off. He was on the tour with Zappa, and he happened to call Perry, and Perry said, come down to the studio right now. And Carly Simon was unhappy to see another drummer there. But Andy Newmark told me about this. He goes, he sat in the drum booth with Jim while Jim did the track. And he said from the very first take, they knew they had what they wanted. But Perry, who's got microtonal issues, took them through 5 hours, maybe 60 takes. Andy said that in all that time, Jim never made a single mistake. And that at the end, his snare drum was caved in like a crater.
Son of a gun.
Who would fly anywhere to see the total eclipse of a sun? What a strange, outmoded fantasy that was from Carly Simon. So I understand that, that's Mick Jagger, who had rendezvous, what goes around comes around, right? Because Mick and Jim Gordon had met on the Everly Brothers 1964 tour of England, correct?
Well, they didn't meet on the Carly Simon sessions because Mick showed up a couple days later and Jim was off, in Sweden playing with Zappa.
Ah, and we might get to Frank Zappa in a second. But didn't they erase, didn't McCartney, Paul McCartney was lurking around the studios and didn't he put his voice on that and they decided to go with Mick Jagger? And Harry Nilsson, and they replaced.
No, it was Harry Nilsson. They were doing the part together. Carly and Harry and Jagger dropped by, and Harry excused himself.
Yeah. And the rest, as they say, is history. You're listening to. We only have a half hour left, and boy, there's so much music I'd like to get to, but I would be remiss not to get to this one. Lenny Warnker. We last saw Lenny Warnker renaming Santa Cruz's beloved Tiki's.
No. Oh. We last saw him producing Arlo Guthrie.
Oh, that's right. I see it. As I say, the earth has cooled considerably since we started this broadcast. We hooked first. He was renaming the Tiki's, and then he produced Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys, one of the worst rhymes in history. Stephen Sondheim would be rolling in his grave on that one. And we're going to pick him up now in 1974, where he has a chance encounter with someone who had been modestly famous but now was working as a waitress. Can you fill us in on what happened then?
Ha-ha, the Maria Muldaur solo sessions. Yes, yes, it was done. The album was done. But Lenny, the producer, and Maria felt like they needed a mid-tempo song to the mix. And there was a number by a friend of Maria's that they sort of liked, but not that much. But it had the right tempo. And they're having this discussion at 11 in the morning, and they wanted to cut the song that afternoon. They couldn't get a hold of Jim Keltner, who'd been playing all the sessions up till then, but they could get a hold of Jim Gordon. You know, Lenny and Jim go all the way back to like high school when Lenny was doing demos for his father's publishing company, and Jim and Mike Post were getting $25 a session from him. And Lenny always felt completely comfortable with letting Jim just do what he wanted. Never gave Jim charts or directions. It was just he knew Jim was an artist. And so Maria got her guys, and they weren't session guys. It was Amos Garrett and Freebo, the bass player from Bonnie Raitt's band. They were folk musicians. But Jim comes in, hears this song, and immediately figures out how to play this record. And bingo, it's a big hit record with this kind of low-key samba approach that Jim devised. And you can feel how he directs the whole track on this.
And I've mentioned a couple times that Henry Kaiser will be joining me next week for the Grateful Dead Zone from 11 to 2. He's told me that this is one of his favorite guitar solos of all time. In fact, his favorite guitar solo of all time. When you think of Henry Kaiser, avant-garde musician, this is the record that it somehow fits perfectly. So without further ado...
Midnight at the Oasis, send your camel to bed. Shadows painting our faces, traces of romance in our heads. Heaven's holding a half moon, shining just for us. Let's slip off. Romance.
the camel song. Wasn't that what they called it when they said...
Streaking consists of racing naked down the block before an audience and then racing for cover before the police arrive.
Oh.
This morning, two naked men raced through a St. Louis police station.
Oh, they did, police did they? That would be from a Rhino Box set called Have a Nice Decade. I was thinking, Joel, have you completely lost your mind? Where are you talking about? Are you running naked? But no, that was in fact a live commercial. So yeah, didn't they call that the camel song? I think was the
yeah, I think so. But what a difference from Why Has Love Got to Be So Bad, huh?
Yeah, and it's again the same musician. I have queued up, but I won't play the Carpenters. He played with the Carpenters, and beautiful track with the Carpenters.
John Denver, Helen Reddy.
Yeah, don't give me an excuse to play I Am Woman. My finger is trembling over the keyboard to play I Am Woman. I'm looking at that I'm looking at that right now. But again, how Synchronicity Man, because we are occupying the space known as the Grateful Dead Zone. The Souther Hillman Furay Band, we played earlier on. We were all over Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Then we talked about the Buffalo Springfield, which featured Richie Furay, who sang very capably before when Neil was not so too confident about his vocals, sang a lot of the great Neil Young songs in the early days. And then David Geffen, this is the mid-70s during the great singer-songwriter scare. So what is David Geffen decide to do to capitalize on that whole thing?
Well, the Souther Hillman and Furay was sort of a manufactured Crosby, Stills, and Nash clone. It didn't launch, but it got the full treatment. Everybody was well known to everybody. Furay, as you say, came from Buffalo Springfield. J.D. Souther had been around for a long time. He was part of a band with Glenn Frey before the Eagles, and Chris Hillman was out of the Birds.
Weren't they the Essential Penny Whistle or some weird band?
Long Branch Penny Whistle.
Yeah, and I knew there was a Penny Whistle in there somewhere.
The drummer on Long Branch Penny Whistle album?
Yeah.
Jim Gordon.
Of course he was. How could I?
And he'd played on Bird Sessions with Hillman, and Furay knew who he was. So when he asked for the job, he didn't have to audition. And this was a part of where Jim's beginning to slip. And he wanted to get out of town. He wanted to be involved in something that could take his focus away from the voices that were beginning to plague him and pester him and bother him and disturb him.
And this is this song, Border Town. Definitely, you can definitely hear Jim is all over it. And it shows no matter if he's falling apart, when the light goes on and he hits record, he's right there.
That's still that's a great track and beautifully recorded. And Jim Gordon, you wouldn't know that the wheels are coming off on that. We're into the late 70s now, Joel Selvin, and
Not late 70s.
Well, now we're crossing. I'm going into the Steely Dan period, so that would be 74. So tell me, how, and speaking of in studio perfectionists, Steely Dan is pretty notorious. How did that come about, and was that a successful collaboration?
Well, they just wanted to start their third album. They decided to go to a workshop thing. They weren't really ever a band. They were a singer, songwriter, and an engineer, and they sort of put the band together so they could fit into the mold. So the third album, they started bringing in session players, and they brought in a young drummer named Jeff Beccaro, who would go on to have an incredible career. He was in the Sonny and Cher band at that point.
Toto, right? Beccaro would be Toto.
Yeah, that's the guy. He went to Grant High School in San Fernando Valley, where Jim went. And the shadow of Jim Gordon falls heavy on Jeff Beccaro. If Jim Gordon had a number one disciple, it would be Beccaro, who played as much like Jim Gordon as you can without being Jim Gordon. And the Steely Dan guys loved him, and he said, yeah, you ought to try Jim Gordon. So next thing you know, Jim Gordon's in there and not Jeff Beccaro. Although by the end, they did do some double drumming together. But really, Jim cut the whole of pretzel logic with them. I'll tell you, you were talking about how fussy they were. I spoke to Dean Parks, who was on all those sessions playing guitar, and asked him what he thought of Steely Dan sessions, and he said, tedious.
You kind of scared yourself, you turn and run. But if you have a change of heart, Ricky, don't lose that number. You don't want to call nobody else. Send it off in a letter to yourself. It's the only one you want. You might use it if you feel better when you get home. I have a friend in town, he's heard your name. We can go out driving on slow hand roll. We could stay inside and play games, I don't know. And you could have a change of heart. Ricky, don't lose that number. You don't wanna call nobody else. Send it off in a use it if you feel better.
when you get home.
Ricky, don't lose that number.
Ricky, don't lose that number.
Ricky, don't lose that number.
So we're getting near the end. That, again, never knew that that was Jim Gordon. I'm on with Joel Selvin, author of Drums and Demons. And now is the demon part. We're in the mid-70s. He keeps playing on great records. Tom Petty's first album, Jim is all over it. Jackson Browne's The Pretender. These are all the things in my playlist that I won't have time to get to that I'd love to. And Discotheques and the Sexolettes, where one could argue that he puts some of that disco beat down. I mean, he's a pioneer all the way through the end of the 70s. And then the demons get a hold of him. If it's possible to encapsulate the last couple years of Jim.
Well, also, we're going to miss a couple of my favorites. I want to mention My Maria by B.W. Stevenson and Grazing in the Grass by Friends of Distinction.
On that playlist, yeah.
And if they, you know, some of us have been hanging in this whole thing, might be able to drill down a little further. There is a Drums and Demons playlist on Spotify. It's 100 songs, 4.5 hours, and that's Drums ampersand Demons. Don't spell out and.
Definitely. I hate to – we usually don't allow people to go off KSQD. They're supposed to listen 24 hours a day. But in this case, we'll make an exception, and there's a great Spotify playlist, and you can track it down. Just Google Drums and Demons and Selvin and root around and you'll find it. And,
I know it's there. But you were asking about what happened to Jim. Somewhere around 75, he started seeing psychiatrists, but he wasn't forthcoming with them. He was experiencing severe, what they call command hallucinations. And those are voices that tell you to do something. And if you don't do it, they give you a headache of severe proportions. Psychiatrists call it the electric hat band. Jim called it white hot cruelty pain. So these things were starting to disturb his sleep, his eating, his playing, interfering with his life, and he had struggled to keep his composure and maintain a position. Very, very difficult. But at one point, he had a fairly, oh no, first he ended his career before he actually broke through. Dylan called and asked him to go out on tour, and the voices wouldn't let him, made him hang up on Dylan. So he was furious, and he called Paul Anka and booked a Vegas engagement with Anka. He took his drums out to Las Vegas, set him up for the first rehearsal, hit the drums, and the voices told him he would die if he hit a second time. He told the musical director he had a psychological problem and he couldn't play. And he went home, and that was pretty much the effective end of his career. Sometimes he went right into the mental hospital after that. He had finally told a psychiatrist about the voices, and that guy put him in residential treatment. He was there for 2 months. Nothing got better. He went home against medical advice and tried to kill himself. And when they brought him back to the mental hospital and he saw the psychiatrist again, he told the guy that the voices didn't care whether he lived or died. So that was what Jim's life was like. These voices, chief among the voices was his mother's. She wouldn't let him eat. She wouldn't let him sleep. She controlled what he did. And this got worse and worse. He really was effectively out of the music business, playing a couple dive bands and bars and stuff like that. But it got to the point where he could just no longer handle what was going on inside his head. And he decided to silence his mother. It was a brutal murder, but he went straight to jail, and he never got out. He spent half his life in jail. He died last year. He was 77 years old. He went in when he was 38.
And became this sort of tragic footnote. And if there's anything that your book, Drums and Demons, does is resurrect Jim Gordon and his music and make it more than just a true crime porn asterisk, which is how his death was covered when it was announced last year. And I know I was obviously had no idea of his accomplishments until I read your book.
Well, it's not just the accomplishments, Eric. You know, in his lifetime, Jim was not the beneficiary of much compassion or understanding. The murder of his mother was so brutal, people just averted their eyes. Nobody came to see him in jail.
His daughter, we talked about Amy. His daughter never visited him in prison?
No, it took Amy a long time to come to terms with this. She was 14 years old when it happened. This is the sort of trauma that you don't ever recover from. It just changes your life forever.
Well, we'll go out. We don't have time to play the whole song, and Lord knows we don't need to do it. But the coda to Layla, was written by Jim Gordon, played by Jim Gordon, and his then-girlfriend Rita Coolidge was an unindicted and uncredited co-conspirator, correct?
I'm sure of that. It happened to Rita before. But she played it for Clapton with Jim. The first time he heard it, she gave him a tape of it. And then after the Layla sessions were over and they were in post-production, Clapton suddenly remembered it and asked Jim to put it on the end of Layla.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Well, Joel, I cannot thank you enough for joining us for this three-hour, as we called it, a tragical history tour. And the book, Drums and Demons, and there's so much music we didn't get to. And, yeah, track down that Spotify playlist. You are listening to KSQD, and, we'll just go out with the Coda to Layla, written and played by the great, late Jim Gordon.
Thanks so much, Eric.